doing to this thing where I was, you know, going to high school is because I also realized that I was in high school and I wasn't learning anything. You know, it's this thing that Carl Jung talk about, directed thinking and fantasy thinking. And I was absorbed in the fantasy side of it. I didn't really know how to connect the dots. And reading was the thing that allowed me to kind of cultivate that sense. And so I wanted to give that as a gift to young people to help them navigate the complexity, because life is complicated. And it's even more complicated when you are poor and disadvantaged, marginalized, and all those other things. And reading, particularly autobiographies, you know, is the thing that helped me. And so I wanted to somehow go back and provide this material to young people.
Keith, thank you very much for spending this time with us live from death row from the Ohio State Prison in Youngstown, Ohio.
Thank you for using GTL.
Ooh, that's what he hears a lot when he's on the phone. Keith Lamar speaking from death row in Ohio. He's scheduled to be executed in 2027. On May 31st, a concert will be held at Joe's Pub here in New York to mark the release of his new album, Live from Death Row. Keith will perform from death row along with the jazz pianist Albert Marquez and others. We also spoke to his lawyer, Keegan Stefan, and Amy Gordeo, director of the Justice for Keith Lamar Foundation. And that does it for today's show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Lock your wigs, let the air out of your shoes, and prepare yourselves for a period of simulated exhilaration.
You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
There's something curious about this broadcast.
Here we go again, it's the game we love.
Tune in on the first and third Tuesday of the month at 11 a.m. for Winner's Bias, a new show exploring the culture around tabletop gaming. From game nights to conventions, Nate and James share what makes the hobby so vibrant through banter and interviews with local members of the hobby game scene. And if we can inspire a few listeners to join us around the table, all the better. More people to play with. Winner's Bias. You don't have to win to have fun, but it doesn't hurt. The first and third Tuesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Cascade Forest Conservancy, presenting the Understory Northwest Film Fest, a night of stories about our connections to the natural world, showing at the Keegan's Theater on Thursday, May 29th. Proceeds from the event support ongoing local conservation and habitat restoration. Tickets and info at cascadeforest.org.
The following program is pre-recorded.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on a special edition of the show, National Book Award winning poet Martina Spana reads from and talks about his powerful new collection of poetry, Jailbreak of Sparrows. Spana's longtime friend, attorney, and Flashpoints legal contributor, Camille Perez Bustillo, will also join us for the hour. All this and more coming up straight ahead. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine on Pacifica Radio, KPFA in the Bay Area. We're coming to you every weekday from 5 to 6. We're happy to have you along, and we are delighted to welcome back to these airwaves Martina Spana. He's got a brand new collection of poetry, Jailbreak of Sparrows. I can tell you it's mighty powerful, and we're honored to have him and his good friend Camila Perez Bustillo will join us. One of these poems, a very powerful poem, is dedicated to Camila
Camillo, so there's a lot to celebrate. Let me read you a little bit about Martina Spana and about the latest book. He's a poet, essayist, translator, teacher, editor, and human rights attorney. Martina Spana has devoted much of his life to the pursuit of social justice, including fighting for human rights and reclaiming the historical record. His critically acclaimed collections of poetry celebrate and lament the working class experience. He is the author of more than a dozen collections of poetry, several books of essays. Espada won the prestigious National Book Award for his book of poems, Floaters. In this powerful new collection of poems, the National Book Award winner offers narratives of the forgotten and the unforgettable. The poems in Jailbreak of Sparrows reveal the ways in which the ordinary becomes monumental. Family portraits, politically charged reports, and tributes to the unsung. Espada's focus ranges from the bombardment of his family's hometown in Puerto Rico, aimed amid an anti-colonial uprising, to the murder of a Mexican man by police in California, from the poet's adolescent brawl on a basketball court over martyred baseball hero Roberto Clemente, to his unorthodox methods of representing undocumented migrants as a tenant lawyer. It is great to have you back, Martina Spada. Congratulations on this powerful new book. And of course, we welcome your brother along, Camillo. Join us. Good to have you both.
Thank you, Dennis. Good to be back.
Good to have you back. And Camillo, welcome. And maybe, why don't you jump
Dennis
in here, Camillo? Talk a little bit about how you met Martine.
Yeah, you know, I'm so honored to sort of pick up the threads of our friendship and our collaboration, especially because of all the ways this book reflects those connections and in all of the ways that Martin's poetry, you know, speaks to the moment that we're currently confronting, all of us here on Free Speech Radio, after all, you know, all of the connections historically that Martin's poetry has always resonated with, but that this book especially, you know, opens and closes with. But also because of the history that Martin reminds us about in this book. I mean, I think one place to begin, I was going to suggest this, Martin, in the closing section of the book, is the ways in which you lead us to think about Trump and how we got here. And specifically, you know, there's a moment of terror that the first Trump administration helped bring about, that you and I connected about in a very personal way. You know, when Dennis asks about how we got to know each other, I mean, it's a long story of a history of 40 years of friendship and collaboration. But one culminating moment was when I was working in El Paso in the summer of 2018, during the peak of the first Trump administration, when family separation was first tested there. And El Paso became the site of what is still the single bloodiest moment of horror unleashed on a community that was targeted because it was identified as a community of Mexican origin. And this has been in the news in the last few days. This is what's known as the El Paso Massacre in August of 2019. And Martin's the only poet who's written about that. And that poem is featured very prominently in the closing section of the book.
Incredibly moving poem, which we're going to ask Martin to read. I want to say it's called The Faces We Envision in the Scrapbook of the Dead. And Martin, would you say a little bit more about the poem and the sort of why you wrote it and why you choose what you choose to put in the poem? Like, it's sort of an alternative way to get information. I do news. But when you do a poem, it's a document that's full of information and making sure that we remember what happened, if you will. Could you talk a little bit about that and read that beautiful poem, that powerful poem?
Surely. First of all, I had to decide how to get into a subject so overwhelming as the El Paso massacre, a subject so big that in some ways I had to locate a part that would stand for the whole. Obviously, I wasn't there, but there had to be a way to take a human-sized approach, to borrow a phrase from the poet Ed Hirsch. And that meant going through the prism of my dear friend Camilo's experience of living and working in El Paso, of using the very same Walmart that would become the site of the massacre, and to try to understand, if I could, what the emotional impact of the massacre was on him. It begins with a moment, as you'll see, of supreme vulnerability in Camilo's life, and then moves from there. So I'll read the poem, and then we can get Camilo's reaction to it. The faces we envision in the scrapbook of the dead for Camilo Perez Bustillo and the city of El Paso. A freak fall, you said. A bad landing, you said. A Colombian from Queens, always wandering a map of unknown places. The tumble down the stairs of the brownstone in Brooklyn ripped your knees from their moorings, ruptured both quadriceps, and in the whirlwind of an instant, you could see the flash between walking and not walking, breathing and not breathing, like a fighter wheeled away from the ring on a stretcher, as everybody prays. The surgeons, resplendent in white, priests hearing the God of ripped bodies speak to them, screwed your knees back on, sat you in a wheelchair the way a ventriloquist props up the dummy on his knee, and sent you home. In El Paso, blood seeping through the bandages, the bathroom a soccer field away, you waited for the boy you named Sently to lift you up, his arms suddenly thick, your head suddenly on his shoulder. You called all your compañeros the night he was born, jolting them from sleep, translating the Nahuatl name, tender grain, deity of maíz in Mexico. Now he drove for Lyft, steering inebriated soldiers from Fort Bliss to the strip clubs who fisted dollar bills for him, then the garters of the girls. Your girl, Lucecita, crossed the bridge from Juarez, a waitress swerving from table to table at the diner, her mother's name on the badge of her uniform. For you, she scrambled eggs with green chiles. The day came you saw in sleep, day of muscle gripping bone like vines curling around the wrinkled trunks of trees, day you could walk with a cane in each hand. At the Walmart by Cielo Vista, near the movie house where you would see Sentley's Marvel heroes in their ropes of muscle, you picked out your canes with ceremony, your boy and girl as witnesses, scrutinizing the aluminum bones, the gray rubber handles, suction cups anchored to the floor, those diminutive spaceships. You paid for the tools of liberation and a roast chicken at the checkout counter. No one could envision all the faces in the scrapbook of the dead. You would stand with the solitary man from Brooklyn and his sign that said, "Free them," at the migrant adolescent internment camp in the desert of El Paso, and found your lawyer's tongue as a carpenter finds the hammer, words nailed in the air, then evaporating in the heat for reporters who could never write as fast as you could talk, who said, "Could you repeat that?" till the delegations from Congress swept into the desert with calls to investigate. You would stand at the microphone, thin as the mic stand, to tell the rallies on the border about the militia patrolling the desert in camouflage, the men who raged of invasion to the migrants shivering in the sand at gunpoint. So you kept talking like a man at gunpoint till the vigilantes evaporated in the heat. August 3rd, 2019. At the table with Sentley and Lucecita in La Ciudad de Mexico, you saw again the flash between walking and not walking, breathing and not breathing in the headlines from El Paso. The shooter left his job selling popcorn at a movie house to navigate 650 miles across the map of Texas, stopping only to scald his throat with coffee or stare in the mirrors of gas station bathrooms, the manifesto he nailed to the message board, shimmering in the mine shaft of his head. The Hispanic invasion of Texas, open borders, free health care for illegals, cultural and ethnic replacement. He meandered through the aisles of your Walmart by Cielo Vista, another boy who would drizzle extra butter on the popcorn, then came back wearing headphones and safety glasses, like a mantis with eyes swiveling in search of prey, the AK-47 at his shoulder, the Mexicans in his sights. Later, as the scrapbook of the dead flipped across screens and newspapers, you saw a face you knew, a man oblivious to the headlines and captions creeping at the edges of his snapshot like black bunting. Arturo drove a bus for the city of El Paso, marched for the army and the Chicano movement, sat a few times at the back of your class called Human Rights on the Border, and would raise his hand. How you long for a beer in a bar with him now. How you wonder if your lawyer's fireworks show of words burst in the sky of the boy with the rifle. Why he drew a circle on the map around El Paso. In the hallucination, you cannot swat from your eyes. You lean on your canes at the Walmart, close to the checkout counter where the bus driver bags the last of his groceries as the crowd stampedes to the back of the store with the gunshots popping in the parking lot, and your knees tell you what your thudding heart already knows, that you cannot flee to dive and roll under a table or a storage bin. Sentley and Lucecita stand with you, refusing to run with the others, leaving their father wobbly on his canes in the medical supply aisle to face the bullets alone. Your boy's arms are suddenly thick around you. Your head is suddenly on his shoulder.
That's Martina Spada reading from his new collection of poetry, Jailbreak of Sparrows. And we're also joined by Martine's good friend, long time, I guess I should say college buddies, poets together, and lawyers. What do you think of that poem? Does it, Martine's conveyance of that action, does it make sense to you? Is it important? How does it deal with the information? What's your impression?
You know, it's a very difficult poem to speak to, of course, because I'm so personally implicated in it. But I guess that's maybe what I want to try to speak to, which is that as humbled and honored as I am to be a vehicle for where Martin got to with the poem, and understanding what it means that my children are protagonists in the poem as well, my Mexican children with whom I used to go shopping in that Walmart on Saturdays, like that Saturday. You know, luckily we weren't there that day, but that's where we used to go. And, you know, this shopping mall, Cielo Vista in Spanish, means a place where you can glimpse heaven or you can glimpse the sky, if we just think about that for a moment. But, you know, these are my Mexican children. You know, these are the children who are being targeted. There were 23 people who died that day. There were 23 who were wounded. There's an incredible symmetry in that. One of them that I think is really the person who should be the protagonist in this poem, along with the others who were killed and wounded. But of course, it was an entire community that was targeted and killed and wounded. Was Arturo Benavides, was his name. His story is told by Martin in that poem. He's the one who was my student in that class, ironically enough, about human rights at the border. He's the one for whose visage I was scanning in that scrapbook, you know, that the title alludes to. And, you know, again, each of the 23 who were killed and each of the 23 who were wounded has a name, has a story, has a face. And I know that one, you know, and that I'll never forget. But I think the other thing I really would like all of those who are listening us to ask themselves is, how does this connect to what we're experiencing today? And the reason, yes, why this book and this poem, but this book is obligatory reading for all of us today at this moment. Because as we speak, as I said, I think earlier, when we were introducing the program, El Paso and this killing is back in the news. I mean, you know, if you look up El Paso online, the topic is the sentencing of the gunman for this killing and what's going down around that. This is almost six years later, right? And the news has been in the last few days. So again, the poem in the book could not be more timely. And this is, of course, this is the genius of Martin's work and his gift. The essence of the story is that what his lawyer has said, look it up, is essentially Trump made him do it. That's the headline. Trump made him do it. I mean, many of us have insisted, I've written about this, others have, from the very beginning, that it was Trump who created the climate through his rhetoric on the campaign trail. And there's another poem, I think, shortly that I hope Martin will read in the closing section of the book that makes this connection very directly. It was Trump on the campaign trail beginning in June of 2016, and it was Trump in the White House in 2019 that created the climate that made this shooting possible. And that's what the lawyer has said, let's say, in the gunman's defense. So Martin can take it from here, but yeah.
Let me just let people know you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are honored to have with us Martina Spott, who's got a brand new book out, Jailbreak of Sparrows. I've been reading it for the last couple of days, spending between rage and tears. Why don't you tell us a little bit, give us a little background and read for us, if you would, the poem The Snake, Martine, please.
Certainly. Just to follow from what Camilo just said, I'd like to add here that there are many times for me where the subject of the poem is the co-author of the poem. And you can hear Camilo describing his experiences, his emotions, his point of view, and see where he is indeed the co-author of that poem in many ways, and I certainly couldn't have done it without him, as the saying goes. I also want to go back to something Camilo said in terms of the headlines, and this case once again appearing in the headlines. And I want to be clear in terms of the poem, that the ultimate responsibility, as the poem details, lies with the shooter, lies with the hand that aimed the gun. But at the same time, I want to underscore something that a professor of mine, Herbert Hill, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison used to say. Ideas have consequences. Ideas have consequences. And when you look at the ideas and the rhetoric with which those ideas were expressed, it was only a matter of time before somebody picked up the gun and put those ideas into action. And that actually leads me to the next poem, because once again we see this rhetoric at work. This is a rather bizarre fact regarding the last presidential election, but if you were to ask yourself who on the campaign trail used a poem, would you guess it was the Democrat or the Republican? Can you imagine Joe Biden using a poem on the campaign trail? Can you imagine Kamala Harris using a poem on the campaign trail? In fact, it was Donald Trump who used a poem on the campaign trail. Now, I should put the word poem in quotes, because it wasn't really a poem. In fact, he was reading the lyrics of a song. That song was called The Snake. It was written by the jazz singer Oscar Brown Jr., who wrote it and recorded it back in the year 1963. And he, in turn, borrowed the idea for the snake from one of the fables of Aesop, the farmer and the viper. Of course, Brown had very different intentions when it came to his song, The Snake. Trump used it as a parable to demonize immigrants. So I began listening, much as it nauseated me, to multiple renditions of The Snake by Donald Trump, which can be found to this day on YouTube from various Save America rallies, including one in Conroe, Texas, that gave me many of the images in the poem. So, without further ado, The Snake. At the Save America rallies, after the damnation of the criminal aliens breaking across our borders and 1,900% more murders, he would ask the crowds if he could read a poem. "This has to do with immigration," he'd say. The crowds would whoop and yip. He'd read "The Snake," words stolen from a song from the hand of a dead black singer who could not snatch it back, a jazz fable spun on vinyl, spun first by the fabulist of Greece centuries before Christ. The crowds would listen to the poem. Bikers for Trump, cops for Trump, Uncle Sam in his beard, the Statue of Liberty in her crown, the millionaire who sells pillows on TV. They would testify in t-shirts that said, "Jesus is my savior, Trump is my president." They would hoist the stars and bars or signs that rhymed Trump 24 or before. They would see the movie of the poem in their heads. The snake frozen on the road. The woman scooping him up tight to nurse him with milk and honey by the fire. The incandescence of his skin brought back to life. The woman's kiss and the viper's venomous bite. Her question, "Why?" Then the words oozing from his tongue. "You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in." The crowd would howl at the moral, at the punchline, at the tender woman who would die of tenderness. Like a preacher spelling out the lesson of a parable, their president would repeat, "Immigration." As they slept, the bikers and the cops, Uncle Sam and the Statue of Liberty, the millionaire on his magic pillow, adolescents from Guatemala scalded the killing floors at the slaughterhouse in Grand Island, Nebraska, their hoses like snakes spewing rivers that bubbled in the steam. Around them, the blades of skull splitters and bone saws waited for their fingers to slip, fangs lurking in the murk of early morning in the days behind the goggles on the faces of adolescents from Guatemala, sleeping the next day at Walnut Middle School, shaken awake by teachers who spotted the acid burns on their hands.
That's Martina Spada reading from his new book of his new collection of poems, Jailbreak of Sparrows, and we're honored to have him along with his good friend, longtime friend, Camila Perez Bustillo. We're sharing poetry with you on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Many of you I know tune in and day out, and this is an informational, a breaking news show, but sometimes there are many ways to deliver information, Martine, and you make a point of sharing history or sharing background so that there's a basis for the story. How do you work with the news? Do you consider yourself sort of the news of the eternity? There's the everyday news, there's the daily news, somebody ran over somebody, and then there's the news of the universe. Well, how do you think of information in the context of poetry?
Well, first of all, it's quite a definition of the news. Somebody ran over somebody. I think that sums it up. That's it. We really don't need to say anything else. Somebody ran over somebody else. That's kind of what the last poem was about, too. How do I see myself and the news, or poetry and the news? Well, there was a poet, I believe it was Ezra Pound, believe it or not, who said that poetry is news that stays news. Whereas I would disagree with most everything Pound said, if he said that, I would agree with it. There is a way in which, first of all, poetry can do what the news can do, liberated from certain kinds of restraints of language. You know this, Dennis, because you've seen it and heard it for generations. You know, the whole notion that we have to convey facts in the driest, most neutral tone and words imaginable. Let's see if we can bore everyone as we tell them what's happening in the world. So I'm freed of those constraints. I'm freed of any sort of pretense of so-called objectivity. What I'm doing instead is using the most vivid language I can render to leave the most vivid impression possible on the reader or the listener. And I'm doing that through the image. And when I say image, of course, when it comes to poetry, I'm referring to all five senses on paper. And that's what you're reading, or that's what you're hearing, those images like boxcars on a train. You string them together and that train starts to move. At the same time, I am aware of conveying information. And that was something you raised earlier, Dennis, the notion of conveying information. And I consider myself responsible to get that right. And so in this book, for example, at the back of the book, there are notes on the poems. And poems like the two that I just read will have extensive annotation that appears at the end. I don't footnote poems. That would be absurd. But there are references to the sources that I read or studied. When it comes to those poems, I mentioned that having to watch Trump deliver the snake and watching his audience become absolutely giddy with glee over it in one Save America rally after another, you know, and occasionally had to run to the bathroom to empty my stomach. But that's part of the process. You know, you have to focus on the that's the evidence, if you will, for presenting the argument. So I do that when it comes to a poem like The Snake. I also did it in reference to watching video couldn't bear to watch in terms of another poem called Wake Up Mario.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, Camilo might want to say a few things by way of introduction to the internet itself.
Oh, you're talking about Wake Up Mario? Mick, Wake Up Mario? Yes.
Yeah.
Very powerful.
Yeah, just a couple of things.
Had me crying last night. Beautiful poem. Come on, please.
Yeah, just a couple of quick words about it, just for folks who are listening. Again, sadly, I don't think enough of us here in the Bay Area know Mario Gonzalez's story, but thanks to Martin and this book, now we can catch up. You know, this is a story from April of 2021. You know, speaking of the snake and speaking of the targeting of people of Mexican descent, you know, in the context of El Paso, you know, what we've been hearing about, you know, Mario was from a family of Mexican immigrant origin. You know, his family crossed the border when he was 3 months old, originally from Chihuahua, Mexico, settled in Oakland. And Mario was killed by the Alameda police. And, you know, speaking of transforming news into poetry, you know, if anybody heard the story, they might have heard the news flash, you know, another cop killing. But this is, you know, a very local story here. And I think the other thing is it has a lot to do with the snake and with El Paso, because it has to do with something we've learned since 2016 and the impact of Trump's policies, which is, you know, the way we try to talk about it is that the border is everywhere. You know, more than ever before, the border is wherever our communities are present, live, work, struggle, and die, like Mario. And so Mario's story is also a border story. It's about the borders between Oakland and Alameda. And I think anybody who knows the kind of enclave that Alameda is can you know, just you can scratch the surface, look up racially restrictive covenants and their history and, you know, that kind of thing. But anyhow, let's let poetry speak.
So, yes, this is a poem I wrote about and for Mario, and had to watch the video that showed me what happened and forms the heart of the poem. Wake up, Mario, from Mario Gonzalez Arenales, 1994 to 2021. Epigraph. He's not doing anything wrong. He's just scaring my wife. Call to the Alameda Police Department, April 19th, 2021. They watched him from the window of the house. A man at the fence in a crooked wool cap, chipping at their tree with a comb, liquor bottles in a shopping basket by his feet. They heard him speak to the wife's mother in the yard, tongue thick in his mouth, heavy with lamentation. He could be the Aztec god of pestilence, no mask, breathing the plague on them through walls and doors. The Mexican nanny might be able to read the hieroglyphics tumbling from his mouth, but she was wheeling a stroller through the streets of Alameda, the trees bowing deeply. On the news, the body cam clip wobbles like the video at a barbecue. The cops are cheerful as they encircle him in the park across the street. He says his name is Mario. One cop scolds this refugee from Oakland about drinking in our parks, wants ID so they can be on our merry way. Mario says, merry-go-round? He steps up on a tree stump as if to ride it. The cops climb off the spinning horses of Mario's imagination, tugging at his arms as he peeks at them from under the cap. Now, they are cowboys at the rodeo, but Mario is not a steer crashing to the applause of hands that would carve him into steaks. The cops shove him to the ground, face down. Mario squirms and bucks. He is the prize at the county fair, a beast who tries to calm his captors, so he spits all the words he knows to make them stop. Oh, God, please, thank you, and sorry, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. I forgive you, says one cop, as the other cop digs his knee into Mario's back, where it stays even after they cuff him, even after the first cop says, think we can roll him on his side. He asks Mario for his birthday, as if there will be a barbecue in the backyard at the cop's house, and Mario, face down in the wood chips in the dirt, with the other cop's knee pressing into his back, wheezes the year 1994. There were cries, then silence. There were no last words. In medieval days, the prisoner at the block would forgive the headsman and drop a coin into his hand for a clean strike of the blade. In Salem's Puritan days, a man accused of witchcraft, after 2 days of stones stacked on him, sneered, more weight. There were no last words from Mario when they rolled him over at last. The last words were in the headlines that same day, jury deliberations 2,000 miles away in Minneapolis. The case of a cop kneeling on the neck of a black man, face down and handcuffed for 9 minutes. In Alameda, the cops began CPR and their incantation over the asphyxiated body, wake up, Mario, wake up, as if he would be late for school on class picture day, as if he would miss his shift at the pizzeria where the paychecks dwindle away. as if he had an autistic brother waiting at home for Mario to help him step from the shower, button his shirt, comb his hair. His autistic brother still waits for Mario. The man who called the cops, his wife's hand gripping his shoulder, says, "We greatly regret what happened and never intended." Says, "Terrible things are being said about us." Says, "Our autistic child is able to read and is terribly sensitive." The sign in front of the dark house says, "For sale." The merry-go-round in Mario's imagination grinds on, creaking day after day. The caller who presses the button to make the horses go. The cops charging like cavalry after the renegade. The dead man galloping ahead, escape impossible. His horse impaled on a pole, kicking the air. The Mexican nanny called Crucita blames herself for rolling the stroller back too late. She visits the altar for Mario across the street from the tree missing a sliver of bark from his comb. The roses wreathing his face shriveled to plastic, balloons gone flat, votive candles cold. There is an autopsy after the autopsy. The coroner keeps the city's secrets, a priest hiding in the confessional. In her sleep, Crucita sees Mario, sometimes a body splayed across the street, breath squeezed from his lungs like the last note from the pipes of a calliope, sometimes breaking free, the painted horse lunging away as he rides along the coasts to the deserts of Baja California, down mountain trails off the maps of Yankee generals and their armies, deep into the songs about bandidos too clever to be caught, revolutionaries the bullets cannot kill.
I'm sort of wondering what Mario would have thought of this poem. What does it mean to have this poem now about Mario?
Well,
why is it important to remember?
Yes, so much of what I do has to do with memory. When this happened, it made national news, and then it was gone. And it disappeared into the oblivion of the law. And ultimately, there was a settlement. There was a payout by the city of Alameda to Mario's family. But it has disappeared. And we know that, number one, Mario should not be forgotten, and number two, there's another Mario almost every day in this country.
Yes.
And so it also behooves us. Yeah, no. Go ahead, Camilo.
I was just going to say, as I think some may know, that, you know, another local part of the story is, briefly, there was going to be a criminal prosecution under new leadership of the Alameda County District Attorney, who was subsequently recalled, and the prosecution was dropped. So, yeah, there was a civil settlement, but there was a criminal prosecution that was erased because of political maneuvering in Alameda County. So just, you know, his case became sacrificed to that. So just, you know, that's also part of the footnote to this.
Absolutely. And again, part of my mission as a poet is to humanize the dehumanized. And the language of the poem first attempts to capture the dehumanization of Mario at the hands of the police and uses language for that purpose. And then at the end, after it's all over, to redeem him, to restore his humanity. And a reminder that he was beloved, that he was a caretaker. He had an autistic brother. All of this. It's so easy to forget as the headlines roll on.
And there's still an altar for him. You know, there's still a place in the collective memory for Mario. You know, I wanted to sort of connect this to the issue of collective memory and historical memory, because that's the other thing I think we have just enough time to do in the closing section of this book of Martin's, A Jailbreak of Sparrows. You draw attention to the sort of the need to rehumanize, let's say, those who've been persecuted, you know, again, thinking of Mario and other connections. And you do it specifically with poets who've been persecuted for their activism, for their beliefs. We're going back now to the context of McCarthyism, but, you know, of course, we're now speaking of the new McCarthyism. But you do it briefly with an extraordinary poet that you and I had the honor of bringing to the mainland for his last reading shortly before his death, 11 months before he died, Juan Antonio Corrêjer, who's been recognized as the national poet of Puerto Rico, one of the most important leaders of the independence movement, who you honor and allude to throughout the book at the beginning and at the end, and have done so throughout your work, on the one hand. And you also invoke the memory of William Carlos Williams, who many may not know was one of your very few predecessors as a Latino winner of the National Book Award, but also may not even know that he had a Latino heritage rooted both in Puerto Rico and in the Dominican Republic. But anyhow, I don't know if you maybe read the poem for Don Juan, and if we have time, the poem for William Carlos Williams.
Please do. And I did not know. I didn't have a clue that he had that background. I loved his poetry, but it certainly wasn't front and center in all the information. And he did suffer. He was also abused, wasn't he?
Yes. So Camilo is asking for two poems, which if I talk really fast, I may be able to deliver. And Camilo has introduced you to the historical figure of Juan Antonio Corrêjer, national poet of Puerto Rico, leader of the one of the leaders of the independence movement and the Nationalist Party, who as a result spent many years in prison, even into his old age. And so I have a very short poem here, which is based on a photograph of Juan Antonio Corrêjer and his wife, Consuelo Litapia, who was also an independentista activist who also went to prison as a result. So this is a poem about a despedida, or farewell, that reflects the emotional landscape of the dissenter. We tend to forget that the people who go to prison, or for that matter, who are deported, are real people with real feelings, with real hearts. The poem is called Breve Pausa for Juan Antonio Corrêjer and Consuelo Litapia. In the photograph, the poet leans over to kiss his wife. He wears a black suit and a black tie, as if there will be a ceremony and a medallion hung around his neck. His hair is white and crowns the back of his head. Her hair is white in waves. She lifts her face to kiss him through his white mustache. This is a despedida. They are kissing goodbye. The charge is conspiracy again. The officers born years after his first incarceration lead him away to Castillo de Ponce. The officers lead her away to the women's prison at Vega Alta. The evidence is in the poetry. As the convoy of the Empire's army rumbles in the dark past the mountain town where one day they will be buried side by side, the poet says to his beloved, Esta es pausa para el amor, es solo breve pausa. The poet watches her sleep. This is a pause for love. It's only a brief pause.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's Martina Spada. You okay, Martine?
Yes, I'm still here.
Good. Right. I think you've got a second one, yes?
William Carlos Williams.
Camilo alluded to William Carlos Williams, and Williams is one of those poets who has been very influential with me, especially his early work. Many people who know poetry are aware of Williams as the poet doctor, who was in fact a doctor who did everything, including delivering children, lots of them, in Paterson and Rutherford, New Jersey. He himself was from Rutherford. And yes, Williams' mother was Boricua, was Puerto Rican. Most people don't know that. They also don't know that Williams was subjected to McCarthyism during the 1950s, that he, in fact, was supposed to be appointed to a position as a consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress, and that disappeared once he was fingered and investigated by the FBI. I managed to get hold of his FBI file, which is now publicly available, and that is one of two pieces to this poem. The other piece to this poem is a postcard that written by Williams that I encountered and actually ended up buying, where he, in his shaky post-stroke hand, as it's called, was writing to Swarthmore College trying to get a gig. That hand was shaky because of a series of strokes suffered by Williams in the early 1950s. So imagine the burdens that he was dealing with simultaneously, both the strokes, the loss of his ability to practice medicine, an FBI investigation, the deprivation of the appointment to be consultant of poetry to the Library of Congress, and yet something in him kept on going, something in him kept on writing those poems.
Martina Spada, thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
It's time to pack your bags and join us for Camp KBOO. Make a summer of memories with KBOO and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give to help us reach our $50,000 goal by June 29th.